Trending Topics.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome back to our podcast where we talk all things mental health and how it relates to codependency. We have a really special guest today.
Woohoo! We have Lisa in the building.
Exciting.
So Lisa is an Asian American therapist located in Colorado. Her therapeutic approach comes from a person-centered and feminist application of acceptance and commitment therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, solution-focused brief therapy, and mindfulness practice. Her private practice, Perennial Therapy, was born from a belief that BIPOC women and genderqueer individuals deserve a specialized approach to mental health care. She is a fierce advocate for gender equality and has a passion for equity, which continues to drive her career and therapeutic approach. You can find her on Instagram under perennial_therapy, or you can visit her website at www.perennial-therapy.com. Welcome, Lisa.
Hello. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
I'm excited. Oh,
jinx.
Yeah, really excited to be here and chat with you guys today.
Yay. So you live in Colorado. I've only been there one time, but it was so gorgeous.
Yeah, I live in northern Colorado, Fort Collins to be exact. We're about like an hour north of Denver. Super beautiful. This time of year, you know, there's a lot of like spring skiing, spring snowshoeing, things like that. So yeah, if you ever get a chance to visit, it's so great.
How long do you have snow? Like how long into the spring can people ski?
Yeah, so typically people can ski till through March, sometimes into April as well, if we have a high snow season. But it's not totally unheard of if we like get our last snow sometime mid-May, end of May. There have been years where like the first weekend of June, we've seen snow as well. It's not every year, but it can happen.
Wow, that's so cool. Megan's a skier, so that's pretty awesome.
Awesome. Yeah, I would definitely encourage you to come out if you haven't already.
Yeah, I've never skied there. I really want to. I want to kind of take a little ski trip to all the different mountains that people say you got to go to. But, you know, you can only do that for a certain amount of months. And
it'll
take 7 vacations in 3 months.
Yeah, no, I totally hear you. And even if you're not a skier, like if you just like enjoy being in the outdoors, like there are so many opportunities and activities to do here that you don't need any like technical skills to be able to like enjoy the outdoors in Colorado, which I think is so great.
Yes.
It's awesome. Wow.
So fun. Yeah.
Well, let's dive right in.
Yeah.
I think the first question we wanted to start off with is, what is the definition of BIPOC? What does that mean?
Yeah. So BIPOC stands for Black, Indigenous, People of Color. And sometimes you can hear it being interchangeably used with, people of color. I think BIPOC became more recently popular, probably around like 2020, when there was a lot of conversation around race, systemic racism in the United States. And so it became more like mainstream language, I think. But yeah, it is often interchangeably used with people of color.
Great. Awesome. Yeah, we wanted to clarify that just in case, because I see that a lot, but then usually it's, you have to use context clues to fully, you know, understand what it means. I didn't want to assume that I knew the full, you know, nuanced definition of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think sometimes BIPOC can also be used to really highlight and uplift the Black and Brown experience as well. And depending on the context that you're talking about or you're using the term. And so, you know, people can use either BIPOC or just people of color. But a lot of times you may hear BIPOC specifically to discuss the Black and Brown experience in the United States too.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Yeah. And at your practice, you specialize in the BIPOC community and children of immigrants, is that right?
Yeah, so I focus on working with BIPOC communities as well as adult children of immigrants. And so just honing in on the multicultural experience and viewing therapy from a more multicultural lens and how our backgrounds, our cultural norms, values, expectations play a really big role in our mental health.
Yeah.
I think that's really important because it's like there's not just one way of looking at boundaries. There's not just one lens to look at all these issues through. I mean, there's all of us are come from different backgrounds, different experiences, different upbringings, and it's important that you highlight these communities because they have a much different experience than maybe someone who's, white, dealing with
How to
these.
set boundaries, all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Yeah, absolutely. In a lot of my conversations with my clients, boundaries, we have these conversations from what I suspect would be different lights or lenses than perhaps like someone who identifies as white, hetero, cis female. Because, we have to take into context the family dynamics they grew up in, the parents they grew up with, right? The many cultures that they're straddling. And so, yeah, it definitely a lot of different topics and conversations come up, even just talking about boundaries. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And we were wondering what, we wanted to highlight if there are specific social and cultural barriers for these communities to, as they're trying to develop their identities or make and maintain relationships or create their self-worth, like what are those barriers specifically in those communities to do that in the in their formative years and as an adult?
Yeah, great question. I think so. It's I know this is like very it sounds very nitpicky, but I think I would really prefer to call them more like challenges than barriers. In that, I think a lot of like BIPOC communities, especially children of immigrants, are straddling multiple cultural lines, right? We're talking about like differing values, expectations, and norms that they're constantly trying to navigate, especially from a young age if they were born in this country. And so asking themselves questions like, am I blank enough, right? Like, am I ethnic enough? Am I brown enough? Am I American enough? And so for children and adolescents, like any teen or kid, you kind of just want to like blend in. You don't want to stick out in any way in that developmental period. And so there's this huge desire and almost pressure to assimilate to the dominant culture, right? And so a part of that can look like, for a really long time, you maybe don't speak your first language outside of your home. You maybe don't eat the food that you eat at home outside of your home. And then as you transition into young adulthood and adulthood, right, there's this constant negotiation of how to incorporate different aspects of your culture into your daily life. And so I think there has also been this like term that has been going around a lot of like code switching back and forth, right? Where we are adjusting our language, our behavior, or even our appearances to fit into the dominant culture or whatever environment that you might be in, right? And so you might act, dress, speak a certain way when you go to work in your corporate job, but that switches very much when you go visit your parents or your relatives. And so constantly going back and forth in those spaces.
Yeah. I've heard the term masking. I think mainly I've heard it actually in like the neurodivergent communities, but does that term apply to what you're talking about a little bit here? Like you're kind of trying to mask what maybe they might do at home because it's not accepted in the situation they're in at that moment.
Yeah, possibly. I haven't heard that term till just now, but I imagine that if it implies that you are kind of like putting on a certain face,
Yeah.
right? Like a certain appearance, of like, I'm no different than you. I fit into this environment, like I belong, quote unquote. Then yeah, I think that idea definitely translates.
Yeah, and I've definitely heard that term code switching before. And I think in the corporate world, it's crazy that that is even necessary at times, or that women of color, people of color feel that that is what they have to do, because corporate culture only is directed into one lens in that way. It's like the white experience. And it's just unfortunate to think that our corporate world can't. There's not room for more identities to show, or just people, being themselves in a corporate setting. It's crazy,
Yeah, definitely. And I think even that idea of like there's this one definition of like what professional is, right? Or like how to succeed in the workplace or what success looks like in the workplace is very much defined by the dominant culture. And so there have been, in my experience and being in the mental health field, like almost a resistance to some of that as well for individuals who don't want to, engage with dominant culture and saying, like, oh, even though I'm a therapist, like I'm going to dress in how I define as professional when I go see my clients. And it might not be like, what you traditionally think of as like, I don't know, like I can't even really think of it right now, but you know what I mean. Like when you think of professional attire, you have this like image in your head, but trying to like resist and fight that with like, I'm wearing what I feel very comfortable in. If that's how I define success, or if that's how I define what's appropriate in the professional setting, then that's okay too.
Do you think that that comes from like other ways of expressing yourself or certain clothes or certain hairstyles being judged in a particular way by that dominant community, and therefore that's the reason they're saying it's not professional, because they're associating it with something negative in their mind because of that judgment?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, because we have this like very boxed definition of what is like professional traditionally, right? That, if we're thinking about dress, hair, makeup, appearance wise, like there is this fear, I think, of being perceived as unprofessional and not belonging in a space that you already feel like was not made for you. Right. And so if you are the only blank, right, only insert an identity, whatever that identity is, going into the workplace, and you already stand out because of a characteristic that you can't change about yourself, right? A lot of people may feel this pressure to at least change their outward appearance to assimilate as much as possible, or to not make themselves stand out in such a way.
It's just heartbreaking, and the idea that to belong is such a human need, right? Like wanting that connection, and you everywhere you go, you're not getting that.
And I think that is one of the biggest challenges that a lot of individuals who hold like the marginalized identity kind of grapple with, right? Of like belonging, constant negotiation of self in the context of the environments that they're in the context of the values that they grew up with in the home, outside of the home, the norms. And I think can feel normal for a lot of BIPOC and adult children of immigrants, because that is the only existence they've known, right? And with that being said, like it's important to acknowledge that it's still continuous like work.
Absolutely. How exhausting. And you mentioned that like changing of yourself, that constant changing of yourself. That kind of leads into the next question, I think, because if that's all you know, if that's how you're getting by, essentially, then how does that affect their ability to learn to set boundaries, have and maintain healthy relationships? Does it affect that?
Yeah, I think so, right? Because if you are trying to establish and maintain healthy relationships with people in your lives, right? Like you have to consider the different aspects of yourself that you're bringing into that relationship, whether it's like friendship, romantic, you know, family, whatever, colleagues. And that can take into consideration a lot of different aspects and variables, right? Even something as, you know, general as like your communication style, right? Like we always say, like in relationships, communication, clear, open communication is really important. But what does that look like when you are going into a relationship with someone who is very different than you? Right, whether it's culturally, religiously, or in any other identity. And so thinking about like communication patterns across cultures, right? Is it going to lead to misunderstanding or misinterpretation? Is it going to lead to stronger bonds, right? And so, for example, if you come from a culture where like direct communication is really encouraged, right? Like direct communication of feelings and concerns or whatever, then you might be praised for that. But then if you go into a different environment where direct communication is seen as rude or confrontational, you may need to then negotiate how you're going to communicate, right? Or behaviorally in those communications, right? Like, are you making eye contact? How is eye contact perceived? Are you bowing, shaking hands, hugging, kissing on the cheek, right? And so, like, constantly negotiating and having to be aware of these, like, very minute factors in setting boundaries, in maintaining boundaries. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Would you say, like, in your experience with working with adult children of immigrants, are they more, I mean, I know it depends on people's backgrounds and their family experiences, but is it harder for them to express feelings and emotions than would you say adults that don't come from parent or immigrant parents?
I think there are certainly challenges, right? Of not only just like communicating your emotions or your like internal experience, but also being able to like identify what it is that you are actually experiencing internally in the context of like external things that are going on around you. And so it is a pretty common experience in my work, when people do seek therapy, that one, like we're very much working on like how do I identify like the emotions I'm feeling, right? What triggered those emotions? What are my emotions like trying to signal to me? Like maybe there's an unmet need that I haven't tend to yet. And then being able to clearly communicate that without fear of judgment or fear of loss of relationship, and things like that.
Yeah, when you're talking about something, I mean, personally, I have a big like abandonment problem, and I'm just thinking if your whole life, all you're doing is trying to not get people to judge you immediately and leave you, do you feel that these communities have a lot of abandonment of, I don't know, ch challenges? Yeah.
I don't want to make a blanket statement. I certainly think that some people struggle with maybe attachment styles that lend themselves to greater fears of abandonment. But I don't want to make a blanket statement that says like if you come from like this particular cultural experience that you're more like prone to or more susceptible to having this fear of abandonment. But But I think it is a really common experience, right? Of like, we all have this innate fear of being criticized or judged. And that fear can trigger us to, behave in such a way.
What would you say the role of codependency plays in these communities? Like, are you seeing that more often than not? And obviously, I know we want to avoid blanket statements, but
Yeah.
how often do you see that in the work that you're doing with your clients?
Yeah. It definitely does come up. And I think there are certain things that can exacerbate codependency. So things, when you are working under like certain systems of oppression, right? And so if your family or the ethnic culture that you come from has experienced some sort of trauma, like war and displacement, then I think those experiences can definitely lend themselves to more codependent relationships. And so, from my experience, when I have worked with adult children of immigrants, it's not uncommon to hear about how parents have depended on their children for emotional support or to help them carry some sort of problem from a very young age. Maybe because there weren't any community resources in their native languages, maybe because there wasn't affordable health, mental health services, maybe there was, financial instability, or there just maybe wasn't trust outside of that immediate community to seek help. And so you are relying on the nuclear family or, your children to help you regulate basically w with the issues that are going on and the challenges that you're experiencing. And, in turn, like that can lead to a lot of codependency and sometimes, feelings of burnout or resentment or anxiety.
Yeah.
Because they're trying, the children are trying to, as adults, learn how to change that dynamic in therapy.
Yeah. Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely. And I can imagine how hard that is coming from, that background, being a child of immigrants, where it's like, you want to be that for your parent. You want to be able to support them and help them through their process. But at the same time, yeah, like leading to burnout and also just feeling like that is your self-worth to that, to your parent, which is like, oh, this is all I'm good for is being this emotional crutch to you. I'd imagine that that's really challenging,
Yeah, and I think, there is this sense of like almost like you are a little bit indebted to your parents for the many sacrifices that they have made, perhaps in like moving to this country, right? And doing all that they have to support your family financially and make sure that we are surviving. And so like there this mentality of like if my parents can suffer 30, 40 years working every single day doing this like very labor-intensive tasks to support our family, then I can support them in this way, or I can, it's selfish of me not to be there for my parents, or, whatnot. Yeah.
That would make sense. That codependent mindset. Yeah, because you do feel indebted to them. You're not worthy of, setting a boundary or having an opinion. I mean, that tracks with everything we've been researching about codependency and codependent relationships.
And even in the context of like not if even if you're not like adult child of immigrant, like if your identity is around like anything to do with like BIPOC or some sort of like racial minority, right? That again, I think it brings in that conversation about like being the only one and having like that experience can also lend itself to seeking out support in a way that sometimes can lead to codependent behaviors.
That makes a lot of sense too. Yeah. Kind of on a side note, I saw a TikTok the other day from an adult a child of an immigrant, and he was, you know, his he was like playing this this like role thing, and he was pretending like he was his dad, and he was like, you know, and his dad's like, "What's wrong with you, son?" And he's like, "I'm just depressed." And he's like, "Depressed? I was working 40 plus hours a week, or I mean, I was working like 80 plus hours a week at your age, and I was doing this, this, and this. No time to be depressed." And I thought that was kind of funny, but also kind of, I mean, I would imagine true for how maybe immigrant parents see depression and see anxiety and other mental health issues is like, we didn't have time for that when I was your age. Like, buck up type thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Like depression, like what do you mean? We're so busy working, there's no time to be depressed. Yeah, anxiety, like you're fine. Just don't worry. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, there's like no space for your feelings.
Yeah, like that internal experience is very much like fix it mentality of like, we'll just get over it. Just don't think about it. There is no time for it. Yeah.
Yeah, that was interesting. When I saw that, I was like, wow, yeah, I mean, I can definitely see that as, and it's not, it's true. I mean, they were so busy at the time that I think, you know, mental health wasn't something that was a priority for a lot of immigrants. And so like, I can definitely understand that lens, but it's interesting as our society, you know, millennials now are seeking out more help for their mental health issues. There's just sort of that struggle between understanding each other between the generations, you know.
Yeah, and I think it brings into the conversation of like, I think people may be more willing to seek out professional support if it's like a physical ailment, right? And so, like, I always talk about with my clients that the mind and body are not separate, it is one, system. And that when you are experiencing physical symptoms because of your mental health, that sometimes even that connection may never be made of like, I feel like physical tension in my shoulders. I have aches and sores, and or I have GI issues because of my anxiety. But you may not know that, those issues are triggered by the mental health piece, right? And so you're seeking this like physical, you might be going to your physician or your doctor and saying like, hey, I'm having GI issues, but never address that like mental health piece of like, I have really severe anxiety, but I'm just going to treat the symptoms.
Yeah. It's so crazy that we live in a society that still sees the brain as so separate from the body. And it's crazy that we're just now coming, you know, trying to accept this as a society where we actually can, you know, by thinking such negative thoughts about ourselves or by just all storing traumas. I mean, it all has to go somewhere in the body, you know, that energy has to get stored somewhere. And so it's just crazy that the rest of the world sees that as kind of like, you know, I don't like woo woo almost, where it's like, you know, I don't know what the other term would be for that, but it's like, it's just crazy to think
I
that,
know.
you know, like, of course it's got to be stored somewhere. I mean,
Absolutely. And so like I some of the work that I do with my clients is learning how to relax the body to kind of send this message to our brains of like, we are not in fight or flight. We are actually completely safe. And so we have to train our bodies to learn to relax, which is kind of like a funny concept, right? Of like, I have to learn to relax my body, as like a skill.
that's so
True,
crazy.
though.
Yeah, it doesn't come, it doesn't come naturally for a lot of us. I think we're always tensed, we're always stressed, we're always in that fight or flight like you mentioned. So
Yeah, because
yeah,
I mean, for me, if I do something that's technically supposed to be relaxing, thinking I'm going to try to relax, all I'm doing is worrying or thinking I should be doing something else.
yeah.
Internally, I don't feel relaxed, but I am technically in the bath.
Like internally, you're still like running through all the to-do lists, all the things that you quote unquote should be doing. And so a lot of times we'll say like stop shoulding on yourself, because the word should can sometimes carry a lot of judgment and criticism. And so there's a lot of weight to that anytime you hear yourself saying like, oh, I should be.
And there's even in those moments of relaxation, we're probably telling ourselves every negative thing in the book, which is like you're lazy, you're being lazy today, all these things. And maybe even someone like an adult child of an immigrant would also struggle with that too, and maybe pressure from their parents of like, why aren't you doing anything today? When it's like, this is called a self-care day. This is what I'm doing for self-care. So I can imagine that's really challenging for that community as well, you know.
Yeah, I think unlearning a lot of the messaging around like rest and leisure, right, can happen in therapy, because it does imply some privilege, right? That you have space and time and resources to engage in some type of rest and leisure. But with that being said, privilege doesn't mean that it's inherently bad, or that you shouldn't engage in it, or that you can't allow yourself to engage in it, right? Because rest and leisure are absolutely necessary in creating some type of balance in your life. And if you have the privilege and opportunities to engage in it, that it can be really really helpful in maintaining your wellness.
Absolutely. I think it's crucial. I think we need to,
Prioritize
yeah. I mean, we can't operate at our best levels if we're not prioritizing ourselves first, right?
absolutely.
So, something that I was kind of curious about is like when it comes to the BIPOC community, what do boundaries look like for like an interracial couple specifically? I just thought found that to be really interesting. My dad's second marriage was to a woman of color, and so they had their own set of challenges in society and within their relationship. But I just wonder what that looks like for those sort of couples. Is it harder or easier to set and maintain boundaries? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, I think with like any couples, right? Like the first thing that comes to my mind is thinking about like what type of communication, again, those like communication patterns and how they play a role in your relationship, and like being able to openly talk about a lot of different topics, right? And making sure that we're speaking from the I perspective than the you perspective. I'm sure you've heard about this at some point, but making sure that we're not pointing fingers and immediately having the other person's like defenses go up, because that makes for an unproductive conversation, right? And we may call that like fighting fair, right, where we speak from our own experience. But aside from that, yeah, I think talking about how differences in the ways we have grown up, the ways we have operated from our cultural context, impacts our current relationship. And so like approaching the other person with a lot of curiosity and the willingness to learn and understand things from their perspective, I think is really imperative to getting to not only their background, but also come to some sort of mutual agreement, goal, right? And also build a foundation of like, oh, these are the things we collectively value together, right? And avoiding like making fear-based assumptions, maybe because we don't understand where they're coming from.
Yeah, that's really key.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do that all the
Yeah, fear is sneaky in that way. Yeah, I think honestly, what you said about just getting on the same page with values and making sure that communication is the cornerstone to that relationship, right? I mean, I think that applies to everyone, but really when it comes to couples, interracial couples, I think it's important to set those foundations early in place to say, look, this is where we're both going to always meet in the middle, regardless of what you might think or what I might think, we're always going to value those same things. And so that's really good point about values.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think ultimately, like in any relationship, and especially with interracial relationships, right? Like you want to stand on common ground, because there are going to be so many things that you have a lot of differences in, right? Yeah, so having that like established clear communication, you know, if conflicts do arise, like fighting fairly, making sure that you have you're aligned in your goals together, and your values, I think is really important.
That totally makes sense.
Yeah, and honestly, like you should always try and be a united front in that way, I feel like, because when the rest of the world is looking at you in the ways that they do, I mean, unfortunately, interracial couples deal with this a lot in society, I'd imagine, where they're just being judged for being together in general. So it's like you have so many outside factors that affect your relationship. Like the one place that should be a safe space for you is that relationship with that other person, right? Like just making sure that that connection is solid, and that if it's not, we get to a place where it's solid again, so that when we go out into the world, we can fight this together, sort of, you know?
Yeah, no, I absolutely hear what you're saying, and that like there are a lot of assumptions that can be made about you and your partner outside, like in the outside world, right? And having that like united front is really important. And I think that also comes into play when you're trying to manage relationships with each other's families, right? Because you and your partner might be really strong together, but there may be some misunderstandings or stigmas or, you know, perceptions that family members have that are different from your collective values and goals and boundaries.
What about the ideas of guilt and shame? Like how does that play a role in these communities?
Guilt and shame come up, I would say, at least once a day for me in my conversation with clients. And so, you know, when we think about guilt, it's very much like action oriented, as in like it's this idea that I did something wrong, whereas shame is more like person oriented, where something is inherently wrong with me, right? And so when I'm working particularly with adult children of immigrants, there is a lot of guilt, I think, associated with, again, this like idea of like sacrifices that parents, their first generation parents have made. And so feeling guilty if they are unable to meet some sort of expectation or need within the family, and if their personal desires or needs go against that, I think there's a lot of guilt. And there can also be a lot of shame too in feeling that way. Yeah, like again, if my parents can struggle for 30, 40 years living in this country and doing whatever they needed to do to give me and my siblings a better life, then surely I can do X for them, or I can do, I should not complain or vent or struggle with my mental health.
Yeah. Does that come up in making life decisions like what job I'm going to get, who I'm going to marry, my sexuality, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it does come up quite often, whether it's talking about like career choices or even, you know, in those conversations about like how to set boundaries with my parents, right? There's a lot of guilt involved in that. And guilt is an emotion that will always be present when you are establishing some sort of boundaries for anybody. And so, especially for adult children of immigrants, it almost feels like you are turning your back on your family member or maybe cultural expectations at times.
Yeah. That's a really good point to make, that guilt will always be present when you're setting some sort of boundary. I think that's important to remember, because oftentimes when I feel that, at least I think I'm doing something wrong. That is a sign I'm doing something wrong. But rather, that's there despite the fact that you're not doing something wrong.
And I think a part of that practice of learning to like identify, set, and uphold your boundaries is learning to manage that guilt and discomfort of doing so, right? And so, no matter the boundary and the person, those are just emotions that are just going to tag along with it. And so we just have to learn how to get comfortable with managing those things.
I think we're so quick to judge our own emotions at times. Like, I do this all the time where I'm like, I shouldn't be feeling guilty, or I mean, I shouldn't be feeling X, Y, and Z, when it's like, it's that should game that you talked about before, too. It's like, why am I saying should all the time when really emotions are always going to be present with anything we do in life, whether they are more positive or negative. But I think just acknowledging their presence and letting them have a place to still be there, but not internalize them, or just kind of observe them as a third party instead of like becoming that emotion of guilt and shame and all those things, right?
Acknowledging doesn't mean that we have to, that emotion is like the end all be all of, our internal experience. It's just one of the many factors, or the experiences that we're having.
It's so hard. It is.
It is. Like all of these things we're talking about, like so easy to talk about, so difficult in practice.
Oh my gosh.
Oh man, it's infuriating.
Exactly. So funny.
What are so in talking about these challenges, if maybe a person who is an immigrant parent is listening to this, what are some things they can do maybe to help their child foster their own sense of self, ability to set boundaries, make it a safe place to do that with them?
I think, the step zero before helping your child is to really identify what role like boundaries plays in your life, right? Are you able to identify areas in your life where you need to set boundaries? What types of boundaries are you setting? Are they flexible and healthy? Are they super rigid? Do you allow other people to kind of like walk all over you? Are you ex overextending yourself? And so identifying those for yourself, I think, is a really helpful process. And then educating yourself on, okay, like, how can I do this with support, right? How can I, in this process, maybe even learn to reparent my inner child to meet the needs that I didn't have met as a young person? And also acknowledge that what you may have needed as a child might necessarily not be what your child needs now. Yeah, because I think there's this oftentimes like in parenting, there can be almost like a trauma response to parenting, right? Of like, oh, my parents did this and that was really detrimental for me, so I'm never going to do that, right? Whatever that is. But really thinking about like, how does that play a role in the context that you're raising your child in, right? And then modeling for your kids, how to identify, how to communicate clearly, how to uphold boundaries, and not taking it personally when your children start to set boundaries with you. Right? Like it's a process really of building a bridge in all of our relationships to maintain that healthy relationship, not a way of like shutting you out. And so, yeah, not taking that personally.
Yeah, that's really key, because like your relationship with your parent, you feel like if they respond in a way that's telling you what you just did is really bad and horrible and is hurting them, and it's unaccepted because it's your parent, you so easily internalize that as, oh, I'm never doing that again. Oh, oops, that was wrong. So that's really, really, I think, one of probably the biggest things is just showing them with your response that you want them to do that.
Yeah, that you're a safe person to practice these skills with, so that when they go out into the world and they have to set boundaries as someone who may not be as safe of a person to do it with, that they can do it with confidence.
I also was wondering if you could maybe shed some light too on what boundaries are and what they aren't, because there's a lot of talk of boundaries in society right now, and I think some people have the wrong idea of what boundaries actually are. I think they some people see it as a way to like control another person or impose their way of living life on that person. So, could you maybe just explain what the differences between what healthy boundaries are and what maybe aren't, like misconceptions of boundaries?
Sure, yeah. Boundaries are not ways where we try to control another person, their behaviors or their words or what they believe or what they're thinking, right? We can't change how other people choose to live their lives and how they present in the world, right? But boundaries are a way of kind of establishing guidelines or parameters as how to how you're going to show up in a relationship, right? So it's very clear to somebody else of like, this is where I begin and end for me, and this is where you begin and end for you, right? And so when we are in relationship, like this is how I respond to these scenarios or these behaviors or actions. And if they don't agree with my boundaries, here's how I'm going to uphold the boundaries. So an example of that can be like if yelling or raising someone's voice in an argument is unacceptable for me, right? And that's a boundary that I'm setting. I'm not going to ask you to stop yelling. But I'm going to clearly communicate that if you continue to yell at me while we are in this conflict or discussion, I'm going to uphold my boundary by walking away or not engaging, right? So I'm just letting you know how I'm going to behave in this relationship.
Yeah, interesting. But yeah, so it has all everything to do with how you're going to respond in a given situation versus you want the other person to do. Like you said, like you can't control someone and say, stop yelling, but you can, however, leave the room because that's in your control.
Right. And I think boundaries are there to communicate to other people how to treat you or how you want to be treated, right? Like what is acceptable to you. And so if you continue to allow someone to kind of walk all over you, right? You're letting them know that's okay. But boundaries, you know, let people know, like, oh, okay, to Lisa, it's unacceptable that, you know, yelling is like unacceptable to her. And so over time, people start to get it, right? Like they either will adjust or sometimes they can't adjust and they may not choose to engage with you in a way that you want them to. Right. And that might mean a loss of relationship.
Definitely. I think in my own life, I've always struggled with, I mean, with boundaries in general. I think they're hard for me to place sometimes, but I always felt like it was hard for me to get the respect from people that I felt like I deserved. And then when I started looking at that a little deeper, I realized like I wasn't setting any boundaries for myself at all. Therefore, it meant anybody can treat me however they wanted. And once I started realizing that boundary work is so important, not just to, for how you want other people to treat you, but also for your self-worth to know that like I am worth a good someone treating me right, someone, respecting me. And so that's just been a huge breakthrough for me personally with boundary work, because I'm like, this is the way that not, you not only respect yourself, but make sure that you put ground, put that out there for other people as well on how they need to be treating you. So,
Yeah, absolutely.
yeah.
Yeah, I feel like my problem is that I will say that this is my boundary or I'm going to do something, and then I don't follow through. Realize that I think in my mind I'm saying that to get them to change. That actually is my goal. It's like a little sneaky manipulative tactic that I'm using, and I don't even realize it. So then I don't follow through because I didn't actually mean what I said. I was just saying that so that you would stop it, and you didn't. So I guess I'll try it again.
That's so challenging, right? Like, but you can't just say boundaries once and expect someone to respect them. Sometimes it requires repetition. And I think that is the work, right? Like, is this relationship worth the work it takes to maintain it?
That's true. It comes down to
Lisa. Gosh.
hitting us with some big ones today. Yeah, I think that is really hard. Yeah, it's extremely hard to do
That's like
that.
my life's work. That's the thing that I'm like, will I ever do this right?
Yeah, and it's, like I always emphasize to my clients of like, no one is a master of boundary setting. Even the therapists who are teaching you and encouraging you and helping you in this way, like we struggle just as much to set boundaries in our own lives. And that's why we call it a practice, right? Because we're never going to really master the skill because it's always going to be really, really hard.
That's good to know. It's okay that it's not easy.
Do you find it in your work that, discussing these subjects with people, especially boundaries, it does it help you through some of your own issues with boundaries by maybe just talking it out with someone else, and then it's like you're having self-realizations as that happens, maybe? Does that ever happen?
Yeah, I certainly learn a lot from my client work. And I think one of the things that is really encouraging for me is when you are in this line of work, you're witness to a lot of trial and error and successes and failures and persistence, I think. And it gives me a lot of encouragement in my own life to do hard things in relationships.
Yeah.
That's big. That's huge. It's hard. That's why it's called hard things, but
Yeah.
I don't want to most of the
Yeah, so I don't want it. That seems hard. No, thanks.
time. Yeah. I'm just gonna ignore this little elephant in
Exactly.
room. Well, Lisa, this has been so fantastic. I think we both learned a ton about the BIPOC community and just boundaries in general. I think these are really important conversations for us to have with our loved ones in our lives. And so we want to thank you so
Yeah,
much.
thank you for doing this. We really appreciate your time.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I could talk about all these things all day. So, yeah, thanks for having me.
Course. Yeah, we'll keep in touch and maybe have you back.
I think we have one final question for you, though.
I do. You guys were so much fun to chat with, and it's been a pleasure to spend the last like hour with you talking about boundaries and how therapy can support, BIPOC and adult children of immigrants. So it's been a pleasure. Thanks.
Love it. Thank you so
Yay.
much, and have a fabulous day.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Thank
Bye.
you. Bye.